We know that there's a lot of variation in development experiences today. We know that there's a lot of variation in the organization of government. So can we do a little bit better in distinguishing different models of successful organization than we so far have been?
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. The modern state and the way in which that state governs is clearly extremely important. We probably spend more time on Vox Dev Talks talking about the actions of government than anything else. Social programs, education, crisis relief, or on the negative side of the ledger, sometimes state violence and repression. Now, we tend to assume that the emergence of government has followed a linear evolutionary path with the modern state as a single end point. But is that really the case? Leander Heldring of Northwestern is the author of a chapter in the forthcoming Handbook of Political Economy that examines the historical data around governments and the types of governments that have succeeded and failed. And he joins me now. Leander, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you, Tim, for having me.
Leander, the usual way that we think about government in economics, if we think about it at all, is that monopoly of violence, a fixed territory, a centralized organization. Does this exclude some pre-modern governments that were successful?
It does, yes. So one of the starting points of this chapter is just to try to map out the historical variation in organization of states and governments. And very much starting from this point, where we have a modern sort of conception or definition of what a state is, which we've taken from Max Weber, who is very much sort of the father in social science thinking, theorizing on the state. And so he was looking at historical Prussia. I'm sure he had a study somewhere, looking out his study window and saying, look, Prussia seems great. Now, what does Prussia do? And so then you write down, what does Prussia do? And then you say, this is a theory of the state. And to his credit, he did make an attempt to contrast what he saw as the right model with models in China, for example. But we've sort of forgotten about that. So we've kind of run with this idea that, well, what defines a state is a number of observable characteristics. So we look at a monopoly of violence, we look at a fixed territory, and those are outcomes of something that we think is a state, and therefore we define that object by these outcomes in the first place.
Right.
Now, that's something that we all do, that I do, but historically, that doesn't really cover the variation. And so just to give an example, there have been historically been many polities, successful and unsuccessful, that did not actually have a monopoly of violence. There's two reasons for that. First reason is having a monopoly of violence is extremely expensive. So you need to pay people to maintain your monopoly of violence. So if you don't have any money, how do you do that? And the second, and perhaps more interesting, is that in many historical societies, the idea of such imbalances of power between people that would give a monopoly of violence to some group, that was antithetical to how politics was run. So in modern economics, the author that has maybe seeped through most on this is the Jim Scott. His book, The Art of Not Being Governed, is basically all about the rejection of the idea of accepting someone else's authority. He took this idea from a longer tradition in anthropology, and I'll just pitch one book, which I think everyone should read, which is Pierre Clastres' Society Against the State, which discusses this idea mostly in Brazil, where in many societies, people have experimented with delegating authority and delegating power to people, and then basically found to not like it. So it's kind of annoying if someone comes and tells you what to do. And so what happens is that the mechanisms develop to constrain those in power rather than enable those in power to exert a monopoly of violence. So basically, societies have experimented with something that looks like that part of the definition of a modern state, and then have said, we don't want it. Now, you might say, okay, fine, that's so far back in history, and these societies weren't that successful to begin with. Anyway, but this is a theme that recurs throughout history. For example, the most successful polities in early modern Europe, like England until about 1600, didn't have a monopoly of violence.
Uh-huh.
The king only had power over the lands he owned. And for the rest, he was dependent on the goodwill and cooperation of the nobles living along the border to protect against the external invasion, for example. So it's not the case that the king had any direct power to tell anyone what to do anywhere. And it was all cooperation based, with that person nominally being in charge. Even today, there's of course variation in the extent to which there's monopolies of violence in different parts of different countries, where we usually think of the absence of a monopoly of violence today as a failure. I cite a very nice book in the chapter by an anthropologist called Louisa Lombard, who studied the government of the Central African Republic, which basically doesn't project any authority outside the capital city. Now, today, again, we think of that as failure. Historically, this was quite often by design, because you couldn't constrain those in power adequately. And like I said, on top of that, very often it is also out of expediency, because you can't pay enough people to actually enforce a monopoly of violence anywhere.
What you've written is clearly not done by you sitting and looking out of a window onto, well, the modern equivalent of Prussia. You have alternative definitions of state and government. What are they?
So there's a few other sort of dimensions that typically come with us thinking about a state. Right? So the second aspect besides monopoly of violence is a fixed territory. And so that historically is not necessary at all for having something looking like a state.
Yeah.
So I have many examples in the paper. I'll just give one, just one of my favorite ones, which is Aidan Southall's anthropology ethnography of the Alur state in Uganda and the DRC, where there was a king who very clearly provided public goods. And then whenever there was a problem, people had a quarrel, they couldn't get along, they would go to the king and the king would mediate. And so the king had a natural authority because people believed there was some power vested in terms of rainmaking and things like that. Doesn't really matter so much. But people would only use the king if it was useful to them. So the king had no power to tell anyone what to do, but people by affiliation would ally themselves with this sort of central authoritative figure when they had a problem. So when you showed up, it's clear that there is something like a state structure here, in the sense that there is a center and there's somebody who provides public goods, like this type of conflict resolution mediation is a prime public good. And people will say, yes, I am part of the Alur Confederacy, or what the right word is, I don't know. But the borders are completely unclear, because the state's boundaries are by personal individual affiliation rather than territorial claim. And, you know, you could think of many Asian historical polities that basically were nomadic polities, like in, you know, before the Saud family settled down and became the, you know, rulers of Saudi Arabia, they were moving around the desert. You can think of several Mongol empires the same way. These are states that are defined by a group of people moving around. So I discuss many examples like that in the papers. That's the second part of a definition that we don't really need. The third part is that typically we think that states manifest themselves somehow physically, right? In a building, or people in suits. And I hope that the Alur example just now is enough to have us think that we don't really need that. So what then do you do? The Weberian armchair definition is very useful for describing historical Europe, but not so much for the rest of the world.
You've just thrown the entire thing away. Yeah.
Yeah, so then what?
Yeah.
So that's not very useful. So you might say, well, okay, that just means that the exercise of having a definition that is encompassing over space and time is kind of a fruitless exercise. And I could be on board with that. I could say, well, look, that is just a definition that works great for early modern Europe. And for the rest of the world, we just need to rethink that a little bit. Now, I try to do something much simpler, which is to say, well, in economics, we have a way of thinking about a government that is not so much to do with outcomes, in the sense that we don't have to observe a monopoly of violence. We don't have to observe a physical building, for example. But in economics, we understand the role of government to be to provide goods and services that the market or communities themselves cannot, for reasons that we understand well that have to do with free riding and collective action problems. So in that sense, the king of the Aluar who I described is very clearly providing a public good. That kind of mediation between communities is something that the communities themselves couldn't do, and there's clearly a public benefit to having someone like that do that. What I just tried to do is come up with a definition of a state, which links that to the very basic welfare economics notion of what is the rationale for government intervention in the economy, to a definition of a historical political community. So I just take the idea of a historical political community from the anthropology literature, and it's not so important, but the definition I use is that a political community is a community of people that share some norms or governance in common. In the anthropological record, it is absolutely clear that even like the smallest groups of people historically had some norms that governed interaction, some norms of what to do when two people get into a fight. Some norms that determine who uses what piece of land, for example. Now, these, importantly, as we know very well, don't need a government. Like, you and I can establish norms and enforce those between us. But for the provision of larger public goods, typically some sort of mechanism is necessary that resolves the inherent issues with doing that. So I link these two ideas in the paper. A state is a political community that manages to provide some public goods. And then the government is the subset of people that does that. This gets us away from things like a monopoly of violence and a fixed territory that don't really work with the historical record, and just focus in on what we in economics think is the core role of government, namely to provide public goods. So then we observe states where some public goods are provided within a community that is a little bit more stable than people just breaking up and coming together every once in a while. I'm not sure if that is a much better definition. It's certainly more encompassing, and it covers cases like the cases in Brazil that I described, or like the Aluar in Uganda, where you show up and there isn't a government building and there isn't a border and there isn't anyone who can tell anyone what to do. But it's very clear that there's a coherent political system here and public goods are being provided.
And I guess when we're thinking about development situations, we're not always looking at states, governments that look like Europe or North America in the way that they are structured. So if we can think about the state in this way, then does that mean that we can do more to think about what sort of state works to provide those public goods?
Yeah, so the usefulness exactly of a definition like that is that does it have some sort of intellectual bite going forward in an interesting way? That's exactly the point. So you might say, well, fine, like you can describe all these historical polities, but the point is they're all unsuccessful. And the ones that are successful are the ones that do become more like a state with a monopoly of violence or a well-defined territory. Mm-hmm. And that criticism is clearly not true. And so I go in the chapter through cases of successful states that actually didn't look like that at all. So let me just give like an example or two. So one example that I've studied in depth is the first successful stage in history. So one way we understand political development is by looking at the first times this happened and why did this happen and how did this happen. Mm-hmm. And so one historical instance of very successful government that I've studied is Mesopotamian governance in the Middle East. Okay, so this Mesopotamia, so southern Iraq, is very much the birthplace of our type of government. It's where, you know, the first law codes were put up, mm-hmm. where the, some of the first states that we then think diffused throughout the Middle East and into Europe, where those came from. And so generations of scholars in social science have basically looked back at that time and said, like, okay, we know that that was a successful government, and therefore it must have been organized in a Weberian manner. So they start looking for buildings, visible signs of a monopoly of violence, etc. But if you actually go into it, here's what happened. The first piece of evidence that I love is that the language that people spoke at the time, okay, people have deciphered that language. After we think the first states, you know, like Uruk, for example, is a place that people have perhaps heard of. The languages that people spoke had no words for government or state or bureaucrat or bureaucracy or officer. It's not a category in which they thought, even though looking at it from the outside, it's totally evident that these places provide public goods. For example, in that context, a super important public good is canal infrastructure. It is in the desert, you need to irrigate, etc. And external defense. Okay, so then how did this work? Well, what happened is that basically the countryside was run by extended family groups that we know very well from the developing context everywhere. And basically what happened when the first states came about is that these family groups basically just scaled up. So instead of having a group with one person in charge and its members being the people that implement the decisions are made within the group, basically what happens is that they convened a meeting of the heads of the groups. And so they now talked, and then they went back into their family groups to, say, help dig a canal. The nominal head of that meeting was the head of the state, but without any power whatsoever to tell anyone what to do. And it's basically the chairman of a meeting. Mm-hmm. And so that is the current state of thinking on how these first states came about. This is one of the most successful states in history, especially at the time, but it looked nothing like what we think a modern state should look like. Let me give one more recent example. I work a lot in Rwanda today, where, you know, at the national level, like, we understand politics, governance pretty well. So you go to Kigali, there's ministries, people in suits, and we know that the politics is dictatorial today. But you go down into the countryside and you realize the following things. One, the state is nominally very small. So it doesn't employ that many people and it doesn't have that much money because it's a poor country. Mm-hmm. But they have this program called Imihigo, which means to pledge. The way this works is that individuals in the countryside go to the government and say, we need this, say a school or a road. And then the government looks through these proposals and accepts the ones that it likes, and then it funds the proposals. But it only funds the capital costs. So for a school, they might fund corrugated iron sheet for the roof. And then people go and build everything. So this idea that the state is basically an organization that implements public goods, even that today is very different because in Rwanda, it just blurs. You know, the state, the government organization blurs into society, and people that aren't nominally appointed or paid by the government help out. Even within the government hierarchy in Rwanda, they have five levels of government, 1.5 thereabouts, out of 5 get a salary. The rest of the hierarchy is unpaid. This is a form of government that from the outside, if you go to the capital, it looks very much like what we think a government should look like. But then actually in implementation, it's a completely different form of governance that doesn't necessarily fit the way we think about that in the West. And in the region, Rwanda is by far the most successful economy. So it's basically in 15 years, electrified the entire countryside, built schools everywhere, built health clinics everywhere. These are just two examples of places that have differently organized than the model that we have for successful organization. And that in their context, historically or regionally today, have been extremely successful. In the paper, I have a discussion of 19th century England, where throughout the Industrial Revolution, only 4% of individuals that worked for the English government got a salary. Everyone else worked next to another job for free on the side. And England only professionalized in the Weberian sense in the late 19th century. So after it got rich, this ties us back to the start of our discussion, which is running a modern government with a fixed territory and a monopoly violence is extremely expensive. So most places historically and today couldn't afford to have a government like that. Yet, many places managed to provide public goods in a successful way. And the organization of those efforts is very diverse based on the sociology of these different societies. There are many different forms of government organization that are consistent with delivering public goods in the end, which ties back into sort of these definitional issues that we discussed.
We have that linear model that I talked about in the introduction, which roughly speaking says better government gets to be bigger government, starts very small and the organizational units get bigger and bigger and bigger. What you seem to be saying to me now is that that is not a predictor necessarily of good government and that this evolution is not a single path evolution.
Yeah, so let me back up there and introduce this idea for a second. We've now discussed different cases that may work well and may not work well. And what we want, of course, then is a model. Suppose there's many different ways of thinking about this. How do we think about successful political development? In economics, we have good models for political change and political development sort of in a democratic context that are mostly theory-based. But for the larger sweeps of history, what we have are mostly evolutionary models. And this is the stuff that is so standard that we get it taught in high school. You know, like societies progress from bands to tribes to chiefdoms to states. Small groups, and at some point they manage to put someone in charge. And then, you know, you go to a chiefdom where the person in charge can inherit their status to their children. And then some point that develops into a state, which is, I guess, supposed to be bigger or more sophisticated. That intellectual program is everywhere. So this idea that we progress in stages and somehow the rich countries are like the last stage. And it shows up in, you know, thinking about low-income countries, lower-middle-income countries, middle-middle-income countries, and high-income countries. It shows up in the third world, second world, first world. It shows up in like the stages of economic development. You know, this was this intellectual program in the 50s and 60s. And it shows up in the thinking that pervades a lot of social science thought on this, which is that if we observe a society that doesn't have something we have, that must mean that they haven't quite gotten there yet. There's some constraint that holds it back. And if only we come and we alleviate that constraint, they would graduate to be more like us. That is straight out of this intellectual tradition, which is at least, you know, 150, 200 years old, on this thinking of a development as stage-based evolutionary development.
When you see the pictures of this, I remember at school, you see the small groups, then they're wearing animal skins. And eventually, when we get to the last stage, then people are sitting in offices and there's aeroplanes flying by.
Exactly right. Intellectually, it's a combination of Darwinian evolution with Marx's five stages leading to communism. So that's the intellectual genesis of all of this. And the first anthropologist that wrote this up in the 1870s and the 1920s very clearly just said that. And then after a while, that sort of that Marxist side gets lost a little bit, but we're stuck with the evolutionary thinking. That would be great if this was a great model to describe the world. What I tried to do is make a longitudinal sample of historical societies and observe them at different points in time and just ask if we can measure their degree of centralization, that is the measure that is used. So how sophisticated is their political development? Do we see that the evolutionary prediction, meaning you tend to graduate up, that shows up in the data? Now, I should flag that this, I think, is the first time an analysis like this has been done, and it's all very preliminary. But if you do that, you can envision sort of a transition matrix from lower stages to higher stages and back. And you basically see that a matrix like that is all over. So the central directional prediction that you evolve up is just not there. You're just as likely to go down or up, and it's all over. So that means that the automatic evolutionary path doesn't really show up in the data. And if you go into the more recent anthropology or history literature, it's also completely evident that's the case. You know, there are societies that experiment with putting someone in charge and building a bigger state, and basically then decide that they don't want it. Here's one of my favorite examples, which is societies that transition between forms within the same year. So you observe this in many different places, but like one of my favorite ones is various sort of leagues of Native Americans in North America that come for one season, come together and organize in a large group and appoint police people that have separate enforcement power. They can jail people. There is a meeting of important people that make political decisions. You show up and you think, wow, they have gotten to chiefdom or state level because they have a bureaucracy, they have people in charge. It seems really functional. And then they do that for a month or two, and then they tear it all down and they start living just family by family in the countryside. So you show up half a year later and they're like, oh my God, they haven't transitioned from band level at all. It depends on which month of the year you show up, then you observe different levels, quote unquote, of development. And so this is just an example to show that many cases you observe something not being there, but it doesn't mean that there's a technological or a knowledge constraint holding that back. No, they have experimented with it and decided to not have it. And so that's a very common observation in the historical record, which sort of goes hand in hand with this data exercise, that this idea that you gradually transition up doesn't really show up in the data. That, of course, begs the question, okay, what is it then? We don't have much by ways of good predictions, good models that would say, okay, well, if it's not some sort of evolutionary progression, then what is it? We have good case studies in history and anthropology, again, of individual societies as they centralize. These are stories of like political entrepreneurship. Look, it's usually entrepreneurial people that try to bring people together in a way that they hadn't done so before, often to gain more power, but then in the process generating more, again, quote unquote, modern state institutions. I don't think we have a good way of thinking about that type of political agency in the development of government. For example, this Imihigo program that I described in Rwanda before, Imihigo is a very old historical Rwandan practice, actually originating in the military, where I formally pledge to keep my promises on the battlefield. And so in 2006, the Rwandan government wants to scale up its public good provision program. And what it realizes is that there is no money, and so they want to bring in society in a sort of more meaningful way. They go back aspects of Rwandan culture, and like this somehow works to bring people into the project. Now, that is a clear example of political entrepreneurship that worked in that case that I don't think we have a good theory for. By the way, if you read like Over the Border in Tanzania, Julius Nyerere's writings early on in his tenure, he writes that he wants that type of Rwandan organization where you bring in people to help with public good provision. And he tries. You know, part of this villagization push that they did in Tanzania was part of to put people in certain places so that you can more easily organize society with them. Now, it didn't really work out there, but it did work out in Rwanda. Now, do we have a theory for that? I'm not sure that we do. So that part of the chapter is a little bit dissatisfying because I bring together this evidence on the like the evolutionary stuff, just not really adding up with the data. But it's equal part dissatisfying and exciting because it means that there's a lot to do.
In terms of a research agenda, where is this most promising, because you have opened up all sorts of possible angles in which we can approach this, but to approach it as an economist?
So one thing is thinking about modern government. We think in modern government, when we go out and we make policy advice to developing countries, we by and large also do this in the same way that we think about analyzing politics historically, which is, well, we have a model of what works, like, I don't know, Denmark or Sweden or something.
We talk about getting to Denmark, don't we?
That's right. The ambition is to get to Denmark. And so the policy advice is simple, which is whatever you are doing as a developing country, you should do much less of it and you should do much more of what we do in Denmark. So that's simple. I think in the organization of government, that may not exactly be right. And again, I'm not going to pretend that I have a better set of theories here. I'm just putting together some evidence that speaks to that. For example, if you look at the data on government organization today, there is a lot of variation, actually, even between rich countries in how government is organized. So what I do, for example, is that I look at simple dimensions of internal organization of government, like security of tenure for bureaucrats, to the extent to which you have to sit exams, etc. Some dimensions of what is called Weberian, quote-unquote, organization of government. And you see that among rich countries, there's enormous variation. Governments are internally differently organized, even though when you look at it from the measurement perspective in the literature and state capacity, which I've worked in too, they're all equally good, quote unquote, because they raise the same amount of taxes or they employ the same number of people. But internally, we go into the details, it looks very different. And in fact, the variation that you see among rich countries shows up just like that among poorer countries. So
really,
rich countries are internally differently organized and poorer countries are too. So among the rich countries, you see in the data that, for example, rich East Asian countries like Korea, Japan, have large governments, raise a lot of taxes. But the way they run their government is actually quite different than rich countries in other places. And so that jives completely with the historical evidence that we just said, that like, well, successful polities historically have been organized differently. Successful states today are organized differently. That doesn't quite yet get to an agenda for social science, because this sounds a little bit more like history in the sense that, say, well, everything is different, so we need to study everything on its own terms. That's not the ambition here, of course. The ambition is to say, well, suppose that there are multiple paths to becoming developed. We know that East Asia took a very different path to becoming developed than Europe did. We know that the African countries today that are successful, Ethiopia until recently, Botswana, Rwanda, they're all organized very differently than Europe is. And even my example for England is, even England wasn't organized in a modern way at all until after it got rich. The causality is almost the other way around. You have to be rich to run a state that we think is associated with development, because it's very expensive to run a state like that. We know that there's a lot of variation in development experiences today. We know that there's a lot of variation in the organization of government. So can we do a little bit better in distinguishing different models of successful organization than we so far have been?
Can this come back to any type of policy prescription? Because sure, there is the criticism of certainly multilateral organizations that they have one model of what good governance is, and that has sometimes been unsuccessful. Then there is that historical approach, as you say, which could lead to saying, well, you do you and we'll see how we do the best with that. Is there something in between where we can say that a policymaker can guide a government, a state, into a model that not only fits its traditions and its culture and the wishes of the people that live there, but we also know would be more successful than what they have at this moment?
My sense is that this is very much where we are as a scholarly community today in terms of realizing that this is important. I'm not sure that we have a set of coherent prescriptions. So I gave the example of Rwanda being able to bring in energy within society, people's own efforts to want to contribute to the public good. And you can get people to build a road and build a school. Another place where I've done field work is Somaliland. So Somaliland is growing very fast. Mm-hmm. And actually, the Somaliland government has been very successful at bringing in people into their development project, except that in Somaliland, you can't get anyone to build a road or a school, but you can get people to help police the border against Al-Shabaab and the Somali government, which you could never get the Rwandans to do. So there is a sense in which the commonalities between the historical English case, between the Rwandan case, between this case, is that what binds them is that they found a way to build a development project, a political project that manages to bring in people rather than build a politics on top of the people with some sort of monopoly of violence over them.
Hmm.
By the way, Botswana is like that too. That seems to be the common thread. The success of the Botswanan political model, of the Rwandan political model outside national dictatorial politics, and the Somaliland model and the English model. I've done a lot of work on South Korea, which grew double-digit percent throughout the 70s and 80s with a government that was small and didn't grow until the 2010s, actually. So it's a fraction of GDP. Tax revenues were the same in 1970 as they were in 2000. But all of these cases, what brings them together is this idea that successful governments find a way to bring in the population in their development projects. That's not really something you can go around and tell countries to do. So that needs to be made precise and needs to be operationalized. But the advantage of pulling that off is that you can run a government which is much larger than what you could afford. Prussia, by the way, we started with Prussia.
Yeah.
So Prussia in the mid-19th century raised about 5% of its GDP in taxes, which is the level of, like, say, Haiti or Yemen today. So this is the most successful state in Europe, maybe the most successful state in the world, that on paper looks as big as today we might say that Haiti doesn't really run a state at all. The capacity or the power to implement policy of the Prussian state, of the English state, of the Rwandan state, of the South Korean state, of the Somaliland state is much larger than its nominal size, because it managed to bring in people into its development project. Only after these places got rich did they transition into paying everyone, into formalizing relationships. Right at that moment where that had happened in Prussia, Max Weber writes down, this is how you should do it everywhere, and this is what a successful government looks like. But Prussia had become successful, not looking like that. After it got rich, it started looking like that. Again, an answer that I hope is equal parts dissatisfying and exciting, because it means that there is a lot to do.
It is exciting. There is a lot to do. Our conversation has taken us from Prussia to Somaliland, but it has only just touched on what you've written in the chapter. Thank you very much for talking about it, Leander.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
The paper is called Historical Government, Origins, Evolution and Varieties. Author, Leander Heldrick, you've just heard from him. Leander, it is due in a handbook. When is the handbook due out?
I would hope somewhere in 2026.
In the meantime, you can read it in its working paper form. It is NBER Working Paper 34370. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode, follow us. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes are at voxdev.org, where we also have articles about the topics that we feature. If you like what you're hearing, tell someone else about us, and please leave us a review. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.